Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It from WNYC. I am Allison Stewart. Best-selling author Matt Haig's new book begins with a Twitter fight. Matt, a self-admitted Twitter addict, can't seem to disengage from the virtual feud or the rest of the virtual world, and it's causing him a lot of anxiety. In his new book, Notes on a Nervous Planet, Matt tries to investigate what it is about the digital age that makes him and millions of others so, well, nervous. Full of helpful reminders, self-esteem boosters, and notes to self, Notes on a Nervous Planet seeks to prove that our collective mental health might really improve just by changing the way we interact with tech. Matt is also the author of the internationally best-selling memoir, Reasons to Live, and his book, Notes on a Nervous Planet, is available now. Matt, welcome.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Is technology and living in the digital age having some sort of effect on your mental health? If so, how so? Do you have any digital hacks, any hacks to how to digitally unplug? We'd love to hear those too. We love advice. Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So Matt, you've been writing about mental health and your own struggles with depression and panic disorder, but what inspired you to write about the intersection of mental health and tech?
Well, I think I was starting to realize it was having an effect on my own life. I think more research was emerging about the interplay of our minds and social media, and not just social media, the internet in general, breaking news, watching Netflix deep into the night, all kinds of things. And I basically didn't arrive at this book with all the answers at all. I just had a load of questions and I wanted to selfishly kind of make myself feel better and understand a little bit more about, you know, why I was letting things like an argument on Twitter ruin my weekend and why I was even engaging in the first place. And that was basically the starting point, because I'd already taken a very sort of personal look, an autobiographical look at my health, but I wanted to look at more of a sort of context, the social context of mental health.
One of the things you write about I found fascinating was panic. And I'm going to read this excerpt about panic. People think panic's like, oh, I didn't do my homework. I didn't get my assignment in. So this is from your book. It's called Reality Versus Supermarkets is the chapter. And it says, people who have never had a period of living with anxiety and panic don't understand that the realness of you is an actual feeling that you can lose. People take it for granted. You don't get up in the morning and think, as you spread peanut butter on your toast, ah, good, my sense of self is still intact and the world is still real. I can get on with my day. It's just there. Until it isn't. Until you're in the cereal aisle, feeling inexplicable terror. When trying to express what a panic attack feels like, it's easy to talk about the obvious symptoms, the racing thoughts, palpitations, tightness in the chest, the breathlessness, the nausea, the tingling sensations inside your skull and your arms and your legs, but there's another more complicated symptom I used to get, one which I have come to realize is at the heart of what my panic attacks have always been about. It is the one called, tellingly, derealization. What is that?
Derealization is something I felt long before I actually understood it or even knew the word. Basically, as the word suggests, it's about a feeling of everything becoming less real. That's like the external environment becoming less real, but also your sense of self, your sense of you. You kind of know in an abstract way that you are still you. I was still Matt, and I was still in a supermarket. But the feeling, the actual sensation of being real has gone. It's almost like you're a character in your own novel. It's an out-of-body experience without being out of your body, literally. But you don't feel quite there. You can't really feel yourself in a physical or mental way. And it's a very disconcerting sensation to have, and but it's actually on the list of all the, when you look at panic disorder, it's one of the official symptoms. And I was relieved that it actually had a word, because it was such an unusual feeling. I thought I was terrified it might just have been unique to me, but obviously it's not. You know, millions of people have felt this, and it's just when the terror gets too much and your brain kind of shuts out. And yeah, it's very dreamlike, but not in an entirely, well, not in a positive way at all, really.
So what is it about the modern world that can lead people to have these kind of experiences of panic and anxiety, and you having these experiences?
Well, I think if there's one word to sum up a lot of the problems with 21st century day-to-day living, I would say that word would be overload. I think we're overloaded. You know, we've talked about information overload for decades now, but we have all kinds of overload. We have an overload of choice. We're conditioned to believe choice is a good thing, but there comes a point when we're saturated with choice. Choice where we get our information, choice of what to watch on TV, choice of what cereal to choose or what shampoo to choose, choice of who we interact with online. We have infinite choice, but there comes a point where it's paralyzing, where literally we're unable to make decisions freely or clearly because there's too much of it, and we feel, as a result, we feel starved of time and of energy very often. You know, the thing to remember is we haven't evolved as human beings biologically for at least 10,000 years, as all the evolutionary psychologists tell us. Yet we are in a world which is changing so fast. I mean, even in the last decade, the way we live, the way we work, the way we fall in love, the way we interact with each other and communicate and get our news has fundamentally shifted. And yet we remain the same. Our brains evolved perfectly to suit the environment as it was 10,000 years ago. Where the most number of people you were expected to have any kind of significant relationship with in a lifetime would have been no more than 150 people. Now, scrolling through Instagram, you could encounter 150 new faces before you're even out of bed. So I feel like it's often just a case of too much.
My guest is Matt Haig. The name of his book is Notes on a Nervous Planet. Matt, let's take some calls. Aaron from Baskin Ridge is calling us on line one. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you? I was calling to agree with the author on a lot of points, but I wanted to add to the conversation that I'm a mindfulness meditation teacher for adults and children. And my colleague and I created a little company around it. We both have our master's degree science behind the contemplative practice of sitting in silence. And what we have found is that connecting mindfulness practice really benefits people to, what you're saying, navigate with our digital devices and communities in a much more healthy, balanced way.
Aaron, thank you so much. Is Dan in Inglewood?
You're welcome. Thank you.
Is Dan in Inglewood there? Hi, Dan.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I think the author makes a great point. You know, what I wanted to try to kind of elaborate on what he's saying is that the way technology is being utilized today, it's moving us more and more into the technological sphere, away from the real world, physical world he's talking about, where you get the good vibes. And the thing is, most of the reason that that happens isn't because technology is bad. Technology is great from what we call in the software world a pull perspective. If you want something right now, I want to reach out to my colleague in India. Boom, unbelievable. I can talk to him. I love it. Right? But the push is the kind of dominant mode of technology today. And it's because the business models of the company are to get engagement. So it's like that Ralph Breaks the Internet movie. You go looking for something on eBay, you get inundated with 1,000 things. And that's where you lose yourself. So I think if we just remember technology is there to make our real physical world amazing and don't get sucked into it. And I'll tell you, the best advice I give people, and somebody gave me, turn your phone on Do Not Disturb. Turn all your notifications off. Only check your phone when you want to, not because some stupid app is bothering you. Thank you for my call. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Actually, that's some of the advice you give in the book, Matt.
Yeah, turn off notifications. Go to social media, but don't let it come to you. It's like the equivalent of unwanted thoughts on your phone that just keep on popping up, and it's not healthy. And the other thing I do, and not everyone can do it because some people like to have their phone by their bed for their alarm, but I now charge my phone in the kitchen overnight. I don't have it by my bed, so at least I have to get out of bed and maybe even make some breakfast before I'm checking my emails and text messages and everything else.
My guest is Matt Haig. The name of his book is Notes on a Nervous Planet. If you'd like to join the conversation, how do you feel about tech and living in the digital age? Has it been harmful for your mental health? Do you have any hacks that you use to stay sane with all of this digital stuff in our lives? Our number is 212-9692, 212-433-WNYC. It's so interesting. Your book opens with you wrapped in this Twitter argument. So you polled a bunch of your followers about how they felt about what this fight was about. And a lot of them said that they think the internet is bad for your mental health. Twitter's bad for your mental health. Why is it so bad?
Well, Twitter specifically, I think, is bad. I think it's deliberately polarizing. I think we can see Twitter actually shaping the real world in negative ways, whether it's the polarization of politics or whatever it is. It leads to, you know, a lot of misinformation and divisiveness. And that almost seems to be its business model. But at the same time, it's incredibly addictive, as all social media is. And, you know, back in the 1950s, they did what we now consider quite unethical tests on lab rats and, you know, about addiction. It was the famous psychologist, Dr. Skinner, who did these tests. And they found out that actually the most addictive thing for a rat is when it presses a lever and gets a treat sometimes, and then presses that same lever and sometimes gets nothing. And I think that's where we are with social media. Sometimes we get what we're looking for, and more often than not we don't, but we know the possibility of some sort of hit or some sort of worthwhile interaction is there. But I mean, each social medium needs to be looked at in different ways. For instance, Instagram on the surface looks like a very, very different place to Twitter, because everyone's nice to each other. It's very happy. People all look like they're having a great time on holiday, and everyone's being really polite. Yet in survey after survey, Instagram comes out as actually one of the very worst websites for mental health, and certainly for young people's mental health. And the reason for that is because it makes people feel a bit bad about their own existence, because they're looking at people leaning against palm trees, supermodels in Mexico, leaning against palm trees, or people, you know, doing this. And they're not seeing the sort of 200 attempts at that selfie that the person is choosing. They're not seeing the various filters that are being used to make that skin perfect, or even now, you know, they've got these apps that make your eyes look a little bit larger. And there was a case, I think it was in the UK, there was a case of a woman who actually went for plastic surgery and asked to have her face look like the filtered version of her selfie, where the eyes were as large as Bambi's eyes. And the doctor said, well, actually, we can do lots of things, but we cannot actually make human eyes bigger, because, you know, that's the size we're meant to be. So I feel like we're increasingly dissatisfied with our own natural selves, or at least being encouraged to be. But I feel like being aware of that and aware of those trends makes us see the sort of ridiculousness of it.
I have an example for you. It was very, very cold here in New York a couple of weeks ago. It was down to four Fahrenheit. And I was walking my dog, and I walked by one of those CrossFit kind of gyms where there's lots of young people and they're working out very hard. And this young woman came out in this tiny outfit, completely drenched in sweat, and was and it's 4 degrees, and she's doing selfies of herself outside.
Wow.
In her, and then I just watched, and then she put her phone down and bundled herself completely up.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah, literally, you know, so absorbed. Probably wasn't even feeling the cold at that point of the selfie, because she was so absorbed in that moment. But yeah.
Or feeling it and not caring, because the image meant more.
Yes, and it is addictive. But you know, to be fair to that person, I mean, these Silicon Valley companies, they use psychological consultants now, and neuroscientists even, to actually help them make their products more addictive, to get more clicks. And the guy, I think his name was Josh Rosenstein, who invented a like button for Facebook, has now come out and said he's got very mixed feelings about that, because you know, he himself has issues of being, he's put a child lock on his own phone, not for his children, but for himself. And obviously the Facebook like button was the one that led to the equivalents on Instagram and Twitter and Snapchat and everything else where you can share things. And he feels it's like, you know, Frankenstein's monster. And we're all caught up in it to a degree. And we're just starting to wake up to the mental health consequences, because people often think, oh, well, people used to say equivalent things about newspapers or TV, and, you know, it's just, you know, old Luddite people who are saying, oh, it was better in my day. But actually, the harshest and starkest warnings about tech use come from people who've worked for Silicon Valley companies, or who indeed still work for Silicon Valley companies and insist on their children going to schools which don't have any technology and are well aware that it is a potential mental health time bomb.
We're going to slide in one more call. It's Vikar from Brooklyn. Hi.
Hi there. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So I just wanted to say that I tend to go on technology fast, where I take myself off of social media, things like Facebook and Instagram, for about a week on average, 2 weeks at a time. And I find that it really helps me regain focus and a sense of direction in my own life, because I'm no longer being stimulated by, you know, things online.
Thanks for the call. It's really good advice. Part of my last couple questions for you, Matt, is you have a chapter called How to Stay Sane on the Internet. Some of the advice is really good. And some of it, it seems like it should be common sense, such as never delay a meal or sleep for sake of the Internet. But the thing that one that I thought was so interesting was you write, stay human, resist the algorithms.
Yeah, because the algorithms we're not obviously always aware of. You know, we'll go on a shopping site and it will say people who bought this also bought that, and it will encourage us to stay in our zone. Or if it's music, we're encouraged to listen to the same thing and becoming our little tribe. And I think it's fun sometimes to be unpredictable, to be slightly beyond technology, to be. You know, we're always trying to be sort of perfectionists now and to have perfect skin and perfect lives and perfect jobs and perfect relationships. But actually, what's going to make us better than the technology and better than machinery is our unpredictability, is our ability to improvise, it's our imperfection. And we need to start to embrace our messy human lives and to see the beauty in that imperfection.
Matt Haig's new book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.